The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's programme...
Should the women of Ireland stand idly by while the most sacred things in life are at stake?
The centenary of Cumann na mBan. Also...
The real reason for the whole civil war in Spain is an issue of class and property.
The 75th anniversary of the end of the Spanish Civil War, plus trench fare, rations and food riots during the First World War. And there'll be more too. But first...
Brown stew. Dredge bone meat in flour. Peel and cut up onions and vegetables. Add salt. Add to the meat. Mix well together. Barely cover with liquid and cook for 2.5 to 3 hours.
Now, it mightn't sound like the most appetising of dishes, but that World War I recipe is typical of the sort of fare that sustained soldiers in the trenches. I'm joined by historians Bryce Evans of Liverpool Hope University and John Borgonovo of University College Cork, who've researched various aspects of food and the First World War. We're going to talk about that now. Bryce, first of all, let's talk about the food that came out of field kitchens to the frontline trenches. The key recruiting slogan from the time was "Join Lord Kitchener's Army, 10 bob a week, plenty of grub to eat." There may have been plenty of it, but what was it like?
Well, the old Blackadder joke, and of course in England, Michael Gove, now the education secretary, doesn't like historians mentioning Blackadder, but you remember the Blackadder joke, what's for dinner? Ratto van, rat that's been run over by a van. Was it really that bad? Well, at the start of the war, not really. 4,500 calories a day was the plan. You look at British rations today in the field, it's about 4,000 calories. So to a lot of recruits from the working class, malnourished as they were, there was that promise of food. It was pretty good. Now, things deteriorated, of course, with disruption to supply, as always happens in war. But, you know, not quite as bad as perhaps popular history would have us believe.
There was red meat available, for example, which would not necessarily have been available all that often to the kind of people that you're talking about who would have joined up.
A lot of red meat, and we think about notions of male fighting potency. The British Tommy wants his red meat. At the time, they don't really understand vitamins very well, but they do understand energy. They understand calories and protein. And red meat is whether it's preserved or fresh, is desired by the troops. The problem is, if you're eating a lot of red meat a lot of the time, a lot of it coming out of a tin, like bully beef, it's going to lead to issues such as constipation, which is a common complaint. McConaughey stew, again, was called by one British soldier a war crime because, this tough, fatty red meat. So led to a lot of problems, people getting bunged up.
And there was a dental war crime in prospect as well, because you had bully beef. The other thing you had was biscuit. So bully beef and biscuit tended to go together. The biscuit was hard enough to rip somebody's teeth out, wasn't it?
Yeah. And you even had, and there's some great accounts of people even making picture frames from these biscuits. So hard were they. So put a picture of the wife and kids in the biscuit, essentially. They were tough. So a lot of the time they dunked them in milk or water to try and make them a bit better. Now, I'm painting a picture here that, you know, the food wasn't that palatable. But, you know, compared to a lot of the situations these guys were coming from, you know, slum conditions perhaps, maybe not so bad. But then you've got the whole other issue of morale. Okay, maybe you're getting the calories you need, but you've got to eat them in a situation of no privacy, in a trench for 2 or 3 weeks. You go to toilet without any privacy as well.
So. Yeah, well, maybe constipation was a good idea in that case.
Perhaps, yeah.
51551, by the way, is our text number. And I know that, for example, one of the staples was plum and apple jam, and the rations were cut from 4 ounces to 3 ounces in 1916. And I'm sure there was a great delight amongst the soldiery that the ration had actually been cut. It was suggested that the tins should be used by the artillery, and there's a song called Plum and Apple Jam, that they should be used by the artillery, and that would, and it would end up, the Germans would end up retreating to Berlin. John, Munster Fusiliers, Cork soldiers, soldiers from the city of Cork would have been, as like the soldiers that Bryce is talking about, malnourished in many cases before they joined up. So would the cuisine of the army have been a plus or a minus for Cork men or Munster men who enlisted?
I think from the cities, from the urban poor, for the cities, it was a good thing. A lot of times they put on weight when they entered, even though they were undertaking these really rigorous training regimes, they put on weight because it's the first time they'd had, you know, 3 square meals a day. You also see one of the kind of shocks for the British establishment was the recognition, because they had all this data about size and weights and heights, about how small their army was compared to other armies from other countries, because their people were physically small, because they were working in these industrial factories without, poor malnourished, not being able to play, not being able to live outside, not being vigorous. And so there was a lot of fear about how they were going to perform, whether they were losing their edge, especially when you start seeing some of the colonial troops come over who had higher height requirements, who look physically a lot bigger, the Australians, the South Africans. They look bigger, stronger, more powerful. And there was kind of a crisis of conscience among the British establishment about where they were going as a society and where this kind of industrial society had taken them.
Of course, there had been steps to address this. I mean, after the Crimea, after the Boer War, there were attempts to improve the diet, and it was taken seriously at the time. And it's interesting that you mentioned the colonial troops, John. I mean, colonial troops were catered for. There were allowances for people who perhaps, due to religious beliefs, couldn't eat the certain red meat and all the rest. So there was a bit of an allowance. And then
later on in the war, when you start getting manpower shortages, they start taking the people who'd been turned away for being too short, and they had the Bantam battalions, people who were 5'5" and under, and who actually look a lot less intimidating.
I read somewhere that something like, was it about 20% or thereabouts in the first few months of the war were turned down for enlistment because of dental problems, not because they were too small or they were too light or they were undernourished, but because their teeth were so bad. I presume that changed within a few months when you had these manpower.
Well, dentistry also takes a kind of big leap forward during the First World War. It's a lot of time people get their first dental treatment. The dental corps is established eventually. Kind of the idea of teeth being a real important element to a fighting man.
I'm sure we're all very grateful for the establishment of more dentistry. Anyway, on to food on the home front. Away from the front line, the war resulted in food shortages, rationing and distribution problems. Food shops were also a target of public anger. For example, after the sinking of the Lusitania by a German U-boat in 1915, resulting in the deaths of 1,200 people, there were food riots up and down Britain. In his 1934 memoir, The Autobiography of a Liverpool Irish Slummy, Pat O'Mara recalls the escalation of tension in the aftermath of the disaster.
It took about 2 days for the names of the drowned among the crew to be published. They were appalling. We walked around Scotland Road listening to the cries of the women whose husbands and sons had gone down in the Lucy, and we heard the bitter threats made against Germany or anything with a German name. We walked down Boston Street, where practically every blind was drawn in token of death. All these little houses were occupied by Irish coal trimmers and firemen and sailormen on the Lusitania, and now these men, who barely 2 weeks ago had carried their bags jokingly down the street, were gone, never to return. Some of the women, drunk, were laughing as mad people laugh when the borderline had been passed. On the corner of Scotland Road, ominous gangs were gathering, men and women, very drunk and angry. Something was afoot. We could sense that. And like good slummy boys, we crowded around, eager to help in any disturbance.
Right, a pork butcher's shop, Bryce, was the first casualty in the riots that followed. Why pork shop? Why pork butcher shops?
Well, they're very visible markers of an ethnic community, the German community. And, of course, Dublin was no exception. There's riots in Dublin, German pork shops at the outbreak of war. If you think about walking down the main thoroughfare in a big British city today, you'd see various markers of, say, the Asian population. At that time, if you read the Home Office files, 60 to 70% of pork shops in London, for instance, were German. So the Germans were quite visible. The problem is that a lot of these riots, as they are wont to do, take a bit of a wrong turn, because every shop with a funny-sounding name is then smashed in, including some Russian shops who, of course, are allies to the British at the time. So we look at the direction of the riot and the direction of the crowd. It's not all a sort of anti-German logic. But at the same time, it was perceived as a war crime. The Lusitania was a big outrage at the time. So there was a sort of moral dimension to it. And when you tie that in with the issue of food pricing and economics, you're starting to go towards not your classic moral economy food riot, but there's tinges of moral economy there. I mean, of course, the riots take a bit of another wrong turn when in Liverpool, and including the Irish slum community like Pat O'Mara, go and smash up the Chinese quarter as well. And China, of course, at that stage is neutral. So we can't say it's a clearly situated thing. Germany's the enemy. Pork and Germany are the same thing. Pricing issues.
You can eat pork. Mm-hmm. I mean, that has to be a factor as well. Are we not talking really here about glorified looting?
In some ways, and we're talking about hungry people, but in other ways, it's an issue of morality. It's an issue of pricing in wartime. And, you know, as John will tell you as well, in wartime, prices always go up. There's always rampant inflation. There's always enhanced morality around consumption. So German pork shops, OK, it's racist, it's moronic, but there's aspects, I think, there's tinges of perhaps an older moral economy there. Now, I don't want to romanticise things, but there's notions there that aren't purely just moronic and racist.
It's interesting because Pat O'Mara does mention in his in this autobiography, this memoir, that certain people were spared. In some cases, people who did actually have German connections, but they were still spared. Why?
Some considerations of the mob for people who gave more on the collection at mass. Say you had Irish women who were married to Germans and they were renowned as putting a few bob in the church collection every week. They were spared. But then he goes on to describe how certain other Liverpool people married to Germans were actually with big families to support weren't spared. So it's a very sort of spur of the moment stuff. But there is, again, a sort of moral logic perhaps to some of it. You know, if you're a good mass goer and all the rest and, I don't know, a daily communicant, you might be spared. So there's issues of morality tied in. It's not just sort of clear-cut idiocy.
There was an upside, though, for the people who were burnt out or whose shops were broken into, whose shops were looted, because they were compensated and sometimes they emerged stronger from the experience.
Yeah, absolutely. And you look at the role of the state. I mean, you know, after the Lusitania goes down, you've got a lot of British propaganda saying, you know, men of Britain, will you stand for this? Avenge the Lusitania. So in some ways, the state's sort of culpable. And if you think about, you know, morality again in wartime and the role of the wartime state in stoking up this sort of, you know, xenophobic resentment, but the state does compensate the Germans. It also interns a lot of them in internment camps for, I suppose, public safety, for their own safety in some regards. But it's an interesting issue of identity, the issue of aliens during the warfare. In terms of O'Mara, he says the most tragic consequence for him is a pernicious bellyache he gets from all the raw sausage he's been eating.
John, there were food shortages in this country in 1970. What was the cause of the food shortages? What was the nature of those shortages?
Well, you start seeing food supplies kind of in terms of what's going on in Britain, you have to feed all these massive armies, these big citizen armies that have risen up. There's been a dislocation in terms of the economy, in terms of you're taking a lot of people out of the economy, putting them into uniform. Crops and farm production went down. And so a lot of the food is being diverted to the troops. So you also start seeing kind of an increase in inflation and food inflation. And in Ireland, you start seeing a lot of stuff disappearing. So, and it's real core stuff that's really important to normal working people. So butter becomes very hard to get. Potatoes become hard to get. Milk is becoming scarcer. It's becoming a lot more expensive. So that starts creating a lot of anxiety. And this really continues into 1918. And in the beginning of 1918, when food rationing is brought in to Britain, it's also, you know, becomes a big issue in Ireland. And probably the big thing driving it is you have unrestricted U-boat warfare in 1917. And so all of a sudden, the North American food supplies aren't getting to Britain. Also, Russia is out of the war. Russia's grains off is taken out as well. So there's kind of a confluence of events has created food shortages in Britain, and that's also kind of spreading over to Ireland, and that's creating a whole lot of public anxiety.
And the Great Famine was actually invoked in all of this. Is that realistic or was that just hyperbole?
Well, it seems very realistic in terms of that was a real fear that they actually thought there was another famine. They also kind of the people who are speaking out, not just the Republicans, also kind of moderate nationalists, they're also evoking kind of the traditional nationalist interpretation that Ireland starved because food was taken out of the country during a crisis. So that's when you start seeing these food preservation efforts. You also start seeing a kind of an outbreak of agrarianism, a lot of animosity towards people who are raising, who aren't tillage farming. So kind of the cow versus plow tension. You know, that just really kind of explodes in January, February 1918. And it's really tied into kind of these shortages that are coming in from this unrestricted submarine warfare. And in Ireland, they're very much aware of this because there's so many ships being sunk in Irish waters. So it's hard to hide from the Irish public how much this kind of the U-boat warfare is affecting food supplies.
Somebody asks a very good question. We're an agricultural country. How could there be food shortages? Was there a lot of food being exported? I mean, I note, for example, one of the tables you have there, that livestock exports from Cork up considerably between 1911 and 1917.
Absolutely. That's what's happening is Irish food is being raised and is being sold in British markets and is disappearing from Irish markets. And that's causing a great deal of unease. And then and on top of that, the inflationary pressures are becoming increasingly high. So for big farmers, this is great. They're making a lot of money. For people who are on fixed incomes, for people who are working in the cities and towns, for people who might not be getting war bonuses, all of a sudden a lot of food is becoming unaffordable. And in some cases, it's becoming unavailable. And what you see in Central Europe, and Bryce, you might want to come in here too, when with countries that you have food shortages and there's a lot of discontent, a lot of time it's not real hunger, it's fear of hunger. And that's what you see in Ireland. And Ireland, when you talk about the Great Famine being a living memory, fear of hunger is a real thing to a lot of people.
I think you've got the role of the state as well. And in Ireland, the compulsory tillage measures are resented by people. It ties into that welter of nationalist agitation at the time, the overbearing state and all the rest. And again, in Europe, this is a big issue. And across Europe, of course, there's food riots. It doesn't just happen in Ireland and Britain. We know, you know, from the Russian example, the German, very good examples of food riots kicking off.
And then also the British government is also highlighting, emphasizing the fact that the Germans are suffering from food shortages. So that's very much part of British propaganda. So all of a sudden, Irish people are starting to see this, and it's kind of raising the worry and the concern among ordinary people to a real a significant extent.
Some of your texts, you are not necessarily looking to plug something here, but somebody on your behalf is, because you're among the speakers at Cork City and County Archives Week, in which four lectures connecting archives with historical research are taking place, and that's Tuesday the 8th of April to Friday the 11th of April. And somebody else emails to say, my grandfather, who was in Gallipoli with the Munster, said they used the jam tins packed with explosives as hand grenades. So they may not have used them against the Germans, but they did use them against the Turks. That's from Kevin in Old Town. By the way, we're looking to hear from people whose relatives were in World War One, because we'd like to feature their stories on our programme in the coming months. So if you have a story to tell us, please email history@rte.ie. Did Sinn Féin capitalise politically on fears of famine or the kind of food anxieties you're talking about?
I'd say they were using it. They were very much to the forefront of trying to whip up kind of action against food exports. But at the same time, they were also working hand in hand with labor. The Irish Labour Party and kind of trade councils were very much on board with this. So it was kind of a joint action. It seems that they legitimately thought that Ireland was going to starve. And that kind of, you know, face that kind of was part of their worldview of how Britain viewed the Irish and kind of their own view of Irish history. They seem to have been legitimately fearful about the case. But at the same time, also, the whole idea of Sinn Féin is ourselves alone, you know, moving forward, us taking care of things ourselves. So it really fit into their view of how the Sinn Féin should govern and how kind of the independence movement would come about. So it was a confluence of good kind of political work things, and it all kind of worked together for them. At the same time, it got a little bit out of hand pretty fast. And it put them off this kind of social agitation, especially later on in 1920 and 21.
Rationing is introduced, Bryce, in 1918. Was that an attempt to resolve the difficulties that had been posed by war profiteering and the perception, and perhaps the reality, that the war was making no impact, in food terms at least, and in other terms as well, on the ruling class? Was it an attempt to resolve those difficulties, or was it a desperation measure?
I think on the one hand, it's a desperation measure, as John's mentioned, the unrestricted submarine warfare of 1917, the German U-boat campaign, which is really damaging British supplies coming in, especially from North America. You know, it's something that's to be repeated in the Second World War, like a lot of these themes are. But it's also to do with that, you know, anti-black market, anti-hoarding message. You do get food queues developing in the major British cities. So it's a bit of both, really, I'd say.
And does, in Ireland, John, does the food crisis pass, or was it just superseded by the conscription crisis in the spring of 1918?
It passes, you know. So you have large scale land seizures and land agitation in January and February. You have a bunch of food preservation committees are set up kind of around the country, mainly by Sinn Féin. But basically, the convoy system has kind of solved a lot of the U-boat problem in terms of ships are now being escorted over, and the sinkage goes way down. So not that many ships are being sunk. And then also the kind of these the food efforts to kind of, you know, they're not beer brewing is reduced to much extent. Bread is being made in a different way, so they're kind of saving a lot of grain. They're also kind of bringing in they'd been laissez-faire before, and the government is really starting to intervene and really control food consumption. And the big, so all of a sudden the numbers start going down, and so demand starts decreasing, and it's all kind of comes together. So things get kind of better. They don't get that much better, but they don't get any worse, and that's what's really important. And then, as you said, conscription comes in about a month or 2 months later, and then that becomes the main focus. But things don't get much worse, and that's kind of critical, and that's because the British government successfully intervened to kind of sort the problem out.
And how close did Britain come to being essentially knocked out of the war in military terms and in terms of the home front after, say, the big German offensive in March of 1918?
Well, you read the stories, according to some sources, it's sort of 6 weeks. You read different sources, 4 to 6 weeks, Britain comes from running out of food supplies. But I suppose that the British are quite successful in imposing rationing in a way that the German home front isn't successful. And there's that aspect, I think, of meat consumption, for one, is always higher in Britain, although it drops, than it is in Germany. And again, if you think of, you know, nutritional consequences as we know today, you know, it's not imperative that people are eating red meat. You know, vegetable diet's more important. But at the time, it's morale. And morale seems to hold in that year, in 1918. I think a big thing as well is warehousing and distribution. So confounding all those stereotypes of German efficiency, the Germans don't have as efficient a sort of distribution system. And the British really avail of a very efficient railway and warehousing system in terms of food supplies in the British mainland.
Couple of your texts before we finish. Margaret Chine says, at least two ships carrying horses to the war in Europe were disabled and put into Queenstown, which is, of course, Cove, County Cork, during the early years of World War One. These events are recorded in the Cork Harbour Pilots Logbook and in Cork Harbour Journals of the time. Both these original records will be on display in the Cove Museum from the 1st of April until October. And Mary McIntyre has a question. She's wondering if you know anything about young Irish men who were conscripted into the US Army in 1914 to 1918. Well, it would have been 1917 to 1918 in exchange for US citizenship. I think my granduncle was one of these. He left Donegal around this time and was killed in a US uniform near Verdun 2 weeks before the end of World War One. He's buried in the American cemetery there, surrounded by lots of Irish sounding names. If anybody's got any information that Mary would love to hear about it. I don't know if either of you have any information on this particular topic. No reason.
A lot of Irish served in the American forces. Pretty much one of the most famous American units of the First World War was the Fighting 69th, which was Irish-American, kind of had an Irish-American identity, made very famous by a movie in the 30s by our very famous Irish-American Jimmy Cagney, playing a cowardly soldier who becomes a hero.
And the Bill Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan,
Wild Bill Donovan, yeah.
to lead the forerunner of the CIA, the OSS.
Just quickly on the subject of horses, of course, a lot of the food going over is for the horses, and some horses actually end up on the plates as well. I did the children's show last week where I wasn't allowed to mention this because the popularity of War Horse and all the rest would have the children crying, but, you know, horses do end up in the diets, in the trenches as well.
Yeah, well, we'll absolutely avoid that one. I won't talk about that one. We leave it there. And War Horse, as you know well, is running currently in Dublin. Bryce Evans and John Borganova, many thanks for joining me this evening. This coming Wednesday, the one-day symposium examining the moral, nutritional, social and economic role of food and drink in the First World War will be held at Liverpool Hope University. Full details of the food and the First World War symposium, they're on our website, as well as additional information about this item. Join us after the break when, among other things, we'll be hearing about memorial cards in Irish culture and the 75th anniversary of the Spanish Civil War.
Text The History Show on 51551.
Indulge in the passion of Elgar's Cello Concerto, Finlandia by Sibelius, Tchaikovsky's Sleeping Beauty, and more. With Richard Harwood on cello, John Wilson conducts Essential Classics. Wednesday, April 9th at the National Concert Hall. Tickets from €11. See rte.ie/co.
The RTE Concert Orchestra. Love your orchestras.
Hi, Mary Bourne here. I'm supporting our Ladies Hospice and Care Services, Harold's Cross and Blackrock, in this year's Flora Women's Mini Marathon. The team and our ladies go the distance every day for their patients, so let's help them out and join me on the 2nd of June. For your race pack, visit olh.ie or call 1850 66 06 06.
Court 2014, A Girl is a Half-Formed Thing, The Sisters Brothers, Cupcakes or Scones, The Spinning Heart, Malarkey, Every Single Minute, The Luminaries, The Flamethrowers, Chocolat, Blackberry Wine, Gentlemen and Players, The Guts, 6 days of prize-winning books and world-class writers in Galway, April 8th to 13th, Court International Festival of Literature, full programme now online at court.ie. Court gratefully acknowledges the support of the Arts Council of Ireland.
RTE, supporting the arts.
You can bring the past to life anytime by podcasting The History Show at rte.ie.
And 51551 for your texts. Welcome back. Down through the centuries, the customs and practices surrounding a loved one's passing have helped us to gain some insight into how different cultures deal with death. Design historian Marianne Bulger now considers one long-held Irish tradition, the memorial card.
While the origins of the memorial card, still part of Irish Catholic funeral practice even today, can be traced back as far as the funeral mementos of 17th century Dutch nuns, in its modern form, it is really a result of the entrepreneurial spirit of the Industrial Revolution. It has been noted that the experience of grief is marked by an illogical desire to help the deceased. Traditionally, the church provided reassuringly official ways to do one's best for the dead. Funeral services and paraphernalia comforted the grieving by giving them an opportunity to do their best and simultaneously reinforced the church's own position as vital to the social order. One clear way to aid the dead was to recite indulgenced prayers, which promised remission for the souls in purgatory. The genius of late 19th century jobbing printers was to recognise the potential of print to combine generic indulgences with the specific details of an individual death, thus appearing to guarantee the application of the remission to one's loved one in particular. By the mid-20th century, the typical Irish memorial card consisted of a generic holy picture, bulk bought, pre-printed from France or Italy, and overprinted locally with an individual's details, indulgenced prayers, and the number of years remission from purgatory that they promised. The inclusion of a photograph and the elaborate typographic treatment of the deceased's name helped to further individualise the intended recipient of the indulgence. The photograph, which became common from the mid-20th century, was usually glued on. In this, it echoed the inclusion of a relic in some forms of holy card, but it could also cause anxiety. If Uncle Gerald's glue came unstuck and his photograph detached, it might suggest uncomfortable parallels with the corruption of the mortal remains. Hence, from the 1970s, lamination became commonplace, the stationery equivalent of embalming. Nowadays, memorial cards take the form of bookmarks, and digital imaging technology allows for secular as well as religious wish fulfilment by literally inserting Uncle Gerald into an imagined better place, on the golf course perhaps, or in a field of sun-dappled wheat.
Marianne Bulger there, lecturer in critical theory at the Dublin Institute of Technology. And on Saturday, the 12th of April, a free conference at Glasnevin Museum will explore the social, economic and medical aspects of dying in Dublin from the 16th century onwards. Grave Matters is being organised by the Dublin Research Group and full details are on our website. And while we're on the subject of Glasnevin, the funeral, as I'm sure you know, of its resident historian Shane McComosh took place this week. He will be greatly missed by all on The History Show. He was a great, great friend indeed to this programme. May he rest in peace. On the line now is Joe Duffy, who's been responsible for compiling the first comprehensive list of child fatalities in the 1916 Rising. Joe, I want you to talk about that, but Shane McComosh was somebody who has been or was of great help to you in compiling this list.
Like so many others that engaged in projects to do with Glasnevin, Shane McComosh was absolutely an incredible help. He was open, inclusive, witty, friendly, extraordinarily knowledgeable. I don't think any one person that has made such a big difference to one single historic institution in this country that Shane McComosh made to Glasnevin in the last few years. He turned it into a cemetery, obviously, as we all know it, into a living museum, a living archive that so many people use. He will be greatly, greatly missed. And as his friend Larkin Collins said at the funeral service in Glasnevin, to those of us at that level that knew him, and Larkin was a very personal friend of Shane's, but it was like a library burning down, but we can't even imagine the grief for his family and friends.
Indeed, and thank you very much indeed for that eulogy, if you like, for the wonderful Shane McComosh. Now, the last time we spoke, you had identified 38 children who were killed in 1916. The figure has gone up since.
Yeah, I now believe, because we did, you were talking about memorial cards there, we did a memorial card late last year just with 38 names on it in an attempt to try and get more information, because I suspect not one of these children ever had a memorial card, because they were children, they all died young, they died in the chaos of the Easter Rising, they died in the crossfire, they were killed, if you want to look at it that way, by both sides, most of them accidentally. And they were forgotten. So when we put out this card, we got a couple of more names. And in fact, Shane McComosh, about a month ago, found a headstone in Golden Bridge Cemetery of Eugene Lynch, 4 Vincent Street, Golden Bridge. Died on the 28th of the 4th, a few days into the Rising in 1916, aged 8 years, from a bullet wound. I couldn't, and still have been unable, to find the death cert. And one of the projects that myself and Shane had was to go up to Golden Bridge. Unfortunately, we will never go there together because of his demise. But that was another name came forward. It was a John Doyle in Summerhill. I found a death cert, bullet wound, killed on April 26th. So I believe the number is around 40. It will change one or two, I think, up or down when we try and get more and more details, because this is the problem with this project, because they were children. They were forgotten, and because they were children, there's not, and have no direct descendants, obviously. There is very little information on most of them, and that is the purpose of the card that we put out. That is the purpose of trying to raise the issue again. It's just simply an issue and a campaign to try and remember them, a campaign of remembrance and reclamation.
And an ecumenical service for the child victims of the 1916 Rising is being held at 10 o'clock on Thursday, the 10th of April, at City Quay Parish Church. You are going to have some of their relatives there.
Yeah, but the reason it struck me that we should do something, it would be the first time in 98 years that the children specifically will be remembered, is that when I was contacting various families and being contacted by families, I noticed that one family, the family of Walter Scott, who was from East Wall, his nephew, as such, or his grandnephew, is a priest, Michael Scott, a Salesian priest in Dublin, and another casualty, Neville Friday, who was originally from Tipperary but was in Dublin on leave. He was with the Canadian Army. A relation of his is Canon Barbara Friday, based in Clonmel. So I just simply asked the two of them around Easter time, would you be willing to lead a service of remembrance for the 40 children? So they're coming to City Quay Church, historic church, as you know, 150 years old, right in the heart of Dublin. I can safely say that the 40 children were killed within 3 miles of that church, because they all died within the two canals in Dublin. So on Thursday week at 10 o'clock in the morning, we're having what is the first service of remembrance. It'll be a gentle service. It'll be reflections on childhood, reflections on the different individuals, the children from City Quay Church. 40 of them will be representing the 40 children. They'll be reading out their names, and we'll get a sense, I think, of the poignancy of what happened, and hopefully for the families, and again, hopefully more families will be reminded or remember or be prodded into saying, hang on, is one of those children not related to us? So hopefully it'll just be another little milestone on the way to reclaiming these 40 lives.
Joe, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Joe Duffy there. Full details of that ecumenical service are on our website. This week marks the 75th anniversary of the end of the Spanish Civil War, a bloody conflict that's often viewed as the prelude to World War II. On one side were the nationalists, led by General Franco and backed by Hitler and Mussolini. On the other side was the Spanish Republican government. Volunteers travelled from all over the world to form military units known as the International Brigades. They came to fight fascism and to defend democracy. Ireland's reaction was unique, as Irish citizens travelled to Spain to fight on both sides. Lorcan Clancy spoke to historian Harry Owens about Irish involvement in the war.
The Spanish Civil War began as a military coup. In July of 1936, General Francisco Franco led a bloody rebellion against the elected Republican government. The three-year civil war that followed exposed deep divisions in Spanish society. Many powerful forces were opposed to the Republican government's social and economic reforms. The church, the army, and particularly landowners were hostile to any changes that threatened their privileged position.
The real reason for the whole civil war in Spain is an issue of class and property. It's about the rich and the poor. My name is Harry Owens, and I'm a member of FIBI, which is the Friends of the International Brigade in Ireland, and I've been involved in issues to do with the Spanish Civil War in Spain and the International Brigades for at least 30 years now. The institutions of power were concentrated in a few hands. Spain, if you like, had fallen behind the rest of Europe, and like in Ireland, land was a red-hot issue.
The majority of Irish people supported Franco's rebels, who were known as nationalists. In the early months of the war, there were many reports of Republican atrocities against the Catholic clergy. Because of this, Franco's rebellion was viewed as a religious crusade.
Virtually the whole country was swept up on the issue of the massacre of the clergy that took place in the first 3 months on the Republican side. Naturally, De Valera couldn't come out for Franco. I would say that De Valera's big victory was his tactical victory in ensuring that he didn't withdraw recognition from the Republic, despite the tremendous pressure he was put under by huge popular demonstrations led by particularly General O'Duffy.
Owen O'Duffy was an army general and politician who had been the leader of the Blue Shirts. He organised an Irish brigade to go to Spain and fight for Franco.
This was very important for Franco because if an independent small country like Ireland backed Franco, it meant the issue wasn't what Franco originally rose about, which is putting down the working class and getting rid of effective democracy. It meant the issue was religion. Franco wanted them for political reasons because it dressed his crusade, as he was calling it, in religious robes and avoided the unpleasant issue of how many were being killed by him and how he was killing them. And secondly, that he was fighting with the two leading fascist powers of Europe.
O'Duffy selected 700 volunteers. The brigade became an official military unit in the Spanish Foreign Legion, called the 15th Bandera.
But when they get to Spain, O'Duffy's men find the war they have come out to defend, which is basically the church, is not in fact on the ground the war that they're being asked to fight. And one of the interesting things they do, to their credit, is they vote massively when their renewal time comes up, an option to go home.
Despite the strong pro-Franco feeling in Ireland at the time, there were some who backed the Spanish Republican cause. The political activist Frank Ryan wrote open letters in the newspaper expressing his support. He also criticised Cardinal Joseph McRory for raising funds at church collections to aid Franco.
And Cardinal McRory then attacks him from the pulpit at a huge pilgrimage. And at that point, Frank says, right, you and the church and O'Duffy are getting ready to go out. We're going to do the same.
Frank Ryan travelled to Spain with about 80 men. They fought Franco's forces as part of the international brigades.
When Frank Ryan brings his 80 men out, people have already come from all over the world to join, and the Communist Party has decided, well, we're going to organise these people into international brigades and make it a proper unit. They were involved in, some of them, in the defence of Madrid. There are fellows from all over Ireland killed. The second big battle would have been down at Lopera in Andalusia, when 9 Irish are killed. And then you had the huge Battle of Jarama, where 19 Irish are killed. You have people going out for a lot of different reasons. An odd one were, there were adventurers, but a lot of them went out of a sense of justice. And also, this comes up again and again when you talk to any of those men in the brigades, they could see the Second World War coming if Hitler and Mussolini weren't stopped. If you look at the Irish who went out with Frank Ryan or went out in themselves to the Republic, or the Irish diaspora who came from many parts of the world to fight, their casualty rate is 28, 29, 30%. They went out to share the sufferings of the Spanish people with the Republic, and they did in every sense.
Lurkin Clancy there on the Spanish Civil War and the two Irish forces who participated. And Ulton texts in to say, could it not also be argued that most Western democracies supported Franco? Their embargo affected hugely the Republican side. 551 for your texts. 100 years ago, we were still pretty much a Victorian society with very traditional values. But there were still women who held strong nationalist views and weren't afraid to speak out.
4 p.m. Friday on Lower Abbey Street. It's the start of the weekend commute for many. Though 4 p.m. 100 years ago on the 2nd of April, it's the location where Cumann na mBan was formed.
When these women met that day to form this organisation, they were doing something that to them was logical. There was no excitement about it. It was matter of fact and every day to them.
And 4 p.m. on the 2nd of April was a perfectly logical time to meet too.
So you're looking at young women who lived at home, who didn't need to work, or young women who were teachers or maybe who were able to be here for 4 o'clock. But you didn't have working class women in this organisation. It was a very class-based situation, just as the Irish Volunteers was. They weren't revolutionary firebrands. Jenny Wise Power, she would be a great example to 21st century young women because she was not very well educated. She set up her own business, a restaurant in Henry Street, and she educated her family on her business acumen and her success. And her son eventually became Attorney General. Agnes O'Farrelly was 40 and Margaret Dobbs was 40 odd. And the two younger women were in their 30s. So they weren't a group of teenagers organising a revolution. They were mature, adult, middle class women.
While some of the women in Wins that day at 4 p.m. were already involved with nationalist organisations or were part of the suffrage movement, this type of meeting was a first for Elizabeth Bloxham.
Elizabeth Bloxham was from Westport and she was a social science teacher. But she said she felt very, very nervous at being at this meeting. And she said to Jenny Wise Power, I've never been at the founding of anything before. What do we do now? And Jenny Wise Power said to her, we just elect ourselves. And so they elected themselves. The executive committee, which was elected after this meeting, and it was a very businesslike meeting, was Jenny Wise Power, Margaret Dobbs, Professor Agnes O'Farrelly, Mary Collum and Louise Gavan Duffy. Elizabeth Bloxham became the national organiser.
At the time, Agnes O'Farrelly put the constitution to the attendees. Its purpose was to advance the cause of Irish liberty, to organise Irish women in furtherance of the object, to assist in arming and equipping a body of Irishmen for the defence of Ireland, and to form a fund for these purposes to be called the Defence of Ireland Fund. But initially, not everyone was on board.
Yes, Mary Kettle, who was married to Thomas Kettle, her father-in-law was a big employer. He was a big farmer out in County Dublin. And Mary Kettle was very concerned that they would be anti-Redmond or anti the Irish Parliamentary Party. And the women had to mollify Mary Kettle that this would not happen and that this organisation was going to be totally outside of politics. And as she was mollified, they then set about setting up the organisation. To them, what they were doing was normal and everyday. They didn't sit there saying, wow, we're part of history now. They were just setting up an organisation, the female version, the Ladies Auxiliary of the Irish Volunteers. It was all very matter of fact.
Well, that's all about Cumann na mBan, which was formed 100 years ago this week. And that was Louise Denver talking to historian Anne Matthews in Wynn's Hotel in Dublin's Lower Abbey Street, where the first meeting took place. Anne Matthews is the author of Renegades, Irish Republican Women 1900 to 1922. You'd have heard a reference there to Jenny Wise Power. Well, this week on Post is bringing out a commemorative stamp to mark the centenary of Cumann na mBan. It'll feature a photo of the first women's executive of Cumann na mBan with Jenny Wise Power to the forefront. Well, I'm joined by Conor Mulva, lecturer in Irish history at University College Dublin and their man working on the decade of commemorations, who's here to take up the story, as it were. Now, Cumann na mBan was described by the historian Cal McCarthy as hardly an army, but not a sewing circle either. So what were they about and how seriously were they to be taken?
I think the Cumann na mBan need to be taken more seriously than perhaps they are. The movement as it was set up received a lot of criticism, particularly from nationalist women who were, let's say, of the Irish Parliamentary Party tradition or more of the moderate or constitutional tradition, because they had done a lot of hard work over a very long period in trying to get votes for women. And for them, the suffrage issue came before the national question. However, for the people involved in Cumann na mBan, the solution of the Irish question had to precede votes for women. And this again goes back to the Home Rule Bill, because there was no provision in that bill for Ireland to make suffrage arrangements different to those of the House of Commons. They had to mirror the Westminster suffrage arrangements. So therefore, for these Irish nationalist women, secure as they eventually went on to attempt to do, a republic. And after that, votes for women will flow from there. So this marks a key cleavage within the suffrage and within the early 20th century feminist movement at the time. So they're an extremely important movement, and I think their work, quite apart from the fundraising work, begins to prove itself to be quite active. And although they're clearly and marked out as an auxiliary doing field ambulance work primarily, they're still a key part of the paramilitary organisation.
They were trained how to use rifles though, weren't they?
They were indeed, and this is another key point. One of the distinctions that's brought out between the Irish Citizen Army and Cumann na mBan is that the Irish Citizen Army didn't make distinctions on gender and that there was equal membership for all. However, Anne Matthews herself has pointed out that the only woman on the 1915, early 1916 roll books of the Irish Citizen Army with an army number and therefore an active member was Constance Markovich herself. So that gender divide may have existed more on paper. And in a conference recently in Kilmainham, this was again brought out by various speakers that even within the Irish Citizen Army, there was a lot of men who turned around and asked women to do women's work as they saw it, making tea and sandwiches, fundraising, these kind of issues. So that gender equality may not have existed on the ground in the Irish Citizen Army in the same way it did. Whereas in Cumann na mBan, they very much were able to clean and service rifles. They engaged in marksmanship shooting. There's a very vivid accounts of the Christmas 1915 rifle practices in the Divis Mountains in Belfast.
Actually, you tweeted a wonderful photograph today, yes, of women actually engaging in rifle shooting practice.
And interestingly, that photo that I tweeted, it's from An Clive Sullis, the Gaelic Leas newspaper, but it's of British women. And this is a photo that the O'Rahilly puts in his paper. And underneath it, he says, here's a photo of, this is all Askelga, but here's a photo of British women engaging in shooting practice. This is something that people in Ireland should look into and investigate further. It's a much better sport than tennis. So we can see that militarisation of women happening very quickly in this period.
Would one of the reasons perhaps that they are not taken seriously or were not taken as seriously as you suggest they should have been due to the fact that a number of prominent members had husbands who were leading figures in the Irish Volunteers?
I've looked through some of the key members and the executives of the movement, and what we have here is a clear split between, let's say, the wives of prominent Irish volunteers. Padraig Colum's wife was Colum, she was involved. The O'Rahilly's wife, Nancy O'Rahilly, was involved. Owen McNeill's wife was involved in the movement. But then there are these independent women who were heavily involved. Agnes O'Farrelly, who's lecturing Irish history in UCD. Constance Markovich has an interesting relationship with the movement in her early days, in that she eventually moves away from it because she says, this isn't feministic enough, this is an auxiliary organisation, and I don't agree with that on principle. But she's involved in the early period. And Jenny Wise Power herself is there in her own right. She has no nationalist connections at that point that would bring her in through any man. She is simply there as an ardent feminist and a nationalist.
Dimpna in Cavan, I presume she's in Cavan, because she wants to point out that Professor Agnes O'Farrelly was a native of Virginia in County Cavan, one of the prettiest towns in the country. Thank you very much indeed for pointing that out, Dimpna. But to what extent, there was an organisation called Inini na hÉireann, the Daughters of Ireland, and I think it was in existence already when Cumann na mBan was established. I stand to be corrected on that. But did Cumann na mBan supplant Inini na hÉireann in any way, or did it complement it?
In some ways, the way that this is written about is that Inini na hÉireann really formed the precursor and do the groundwork, and that's why Cumann na mBan is essentially, it constitutes a hardening of attitudes of Irish nationalist women's movements at this point. Inini are in existence from 1900 onwards, so they're a long established movement. And there's also the Clonagail Girls, who are basically a girls' equivalent of the Nationalist Boy Scouts founded by Bulmer Hobson and Constance Markovich. So there are these pre-existent women's movements. However, Cumann na mBan really brings this to a new level. And when they're founded, after a very short months, I think it's in May of 1914, Inini na hÉireann form themselves and constitute as the second Dublin branch. So there's a centre branch, and there's also an Inini na hÉireann branch of Cumann na mBan. So it subsumes itself voluntarily into the Cumann na mBan organisation.
Question from a texter: how many members did Cumann na mBan attract?
This is a difficult question to answer. What we have, Cal McCarthy's book on Cumann na mBan is quite good on this, and she reckons that on the eve of the 1916 rising, there are splits within Cumann na mBan, and this is something that I'll go on to talk about in a minute, but there are roughly 650 members by the eve of the 1916 rising.
Somebody else asked, were there any working class women in the organisation? It does have a very middle class reputation.
This is where, again, after the 1916 Rising, that there's a popularisation of the Republican movement in general. There are key barriers to entry within Cumannamon that preclude working class women from joining it. One is, even we heard there in the excerpt at the start, it was 4 p.m. that the first meeting that to inaugurate Cumannamon was held. Any woman with a job would have been working at 4 p.m. On a Tuesday afternoon and therefore couldn't have gone. It was also a shilling to join up to Cumannamon, which represented a significant amount of women's wages, particularly at this time. So there are key barriers to entry. And then finally, when a ball for Cumannamon is held nationally at the time, there are examples from outlying units and provincial units of Cumannamon where working women aren't invited and it's for ladies only. So there's clear class distinctions there.
You mentioned splits. Let's talk about two of them, because there was one split when war was declared and then there was a further split, and that was a treaty-related split. Let's talk about the 1914 split, first of all.
So John Redmond's Woodenbridge speech splits the Irish Volunteers in September and October of 1914. This mirrors a movement within Cumannamon, and the same split occurs. So Cumannamon splits in this period, and what we see is that although the executive largely side with the minority Owen McNeill's Irish Volunteers, it seems that a large number of the rank and file sided with the National Volunteers. And just like the National Volunteers, they seem to have fallen away. So it's the minority who maintain activity and go on to become the 650 members active on the eve of the 1916 Rising. Now, obviously, 650 don't participate. The second split then occurs after the treaty, when Cumannamon splits in two over the issue. There's a wonderful illustration on the back cover of Anne Matthews' book, which shows the pro-treaty Cumannamon making bread and sandwiches in this period. So I think that marks a key distinction for me between the work of the pro-treaty and the anti-treaty Cumannamon, who are extremely active in the Republican side of the split in the Civil War. The pro-treaty Cumannamon go on to form Cumannis Éireann, and Jenny Wise Power, who's involved from the very start, splits at that point, and she's seen as being a traitor by many in the Republican movement after siding with the Free State after so long.
Now, we're joined on the line from North Galway by Mary Murphy, biographer of Eva O'Flaherty, feminist and member of Cumannamon. Mary, you're very welcome to the programme. Tell us about the involvement of Eva O'Flaherty in Cumannamon.
Thank you, Miles, and good evening. And I was looking at that photograph from the Clive Sullivan from 1913 earlier, and what struck me about those ladies with their rifles was the hats they were wearing, because Eva O'Flaherty, in fact, was a milliner. She had two extraordinary interests all of her life, nationalism and millinery and fashion. She actually ran the St. Coleman's knitting industries in Achill for over 50 years. But she came hot foot from London to Dublin in 1914, and it's actually in Louise Gavan Duffy's, in her witness statement 216 to the Bureau, the Military Bureau, that's where we first found the mention of Eva O'Flaherty. She's called Miss O'Flaherty of Achill, was a paid secretary for some time on O'Connell Street with Louise O'Flaherty. And we also know from her obituaries in the Irish Times when she died in 1963 that she knew and was involved with Countess Markovitch and Maud Gonne. She was friendly and wrote to Dr. Kathleen Lynn and Moira Comerford and Anita McMahon all of their lives. They seemed to have been a very close group of friends. And we also know that Mr. De Valera sent Mark Killalea to give a narration at Eva O'Flaherty's burial in Donnapatrick Graveyard in Carlistran. And at that, people, it's just 50 years ago, so there are quite a number of people alive who remember it. He spoke at length of Miss O'Flaherty, as they called her, her involvement with Cumannamon. She was given full military honours and there was a tricolour on her coffin. So we're perfectly clear that she had, at least for a time, she would have been in at the early end, the genteel, the beginnings of Cumannamon, because Eva O'Flaherty was born in Listonna House here in Carlistran. She certainly had a silver spoon-like existence in her initial years. Then she went to Alexandra Mount Anvil. She was in Paris. She was in Limerick, London.
But she was also apparently very well organised when it came to Cumannamon, wasn't she?
She was extremely well organised. We have from Louise Gavan Duffy's own words, the witness, the statement she gave. She speaks of how she recalls the way this Miss O'Flaherty kept such close account of every stamp that she sent, to all of the letters to whom she would have been sending letters to people in the organisation. So even though it appears she wasn't a member of Cumannamon for any great length of time, she stuck firmly in Louise Gavan Duffy's mind as having been somebody that was of some substance. And we know from people who did know her, she had an extraordinary personality.
Okay. Connor, we referred earlier to the fact that Cumannamon was hardly an army, this is the Cal McCarthy quote, hardly an army but not a sewing circle either. They were involved in the 1916 Rising, and a number of them were killed and injured.
They were indeed. And famously, I suppose there were two female members, not just ICA, but not just Cumann na mBan, but also ICA, Irish Citizen Army members, who were keenly involved in the 1916 Rising. One is Kathleen Lynn, who, as medical officer, is one of the senior participants in the Rising, and she organises the surrender. The second is, and again, my memory escapes here, but Elizabeth O'Farrell, I think, takes the surrender with Pádraig Pearse, and there is that famous photo of Pearse issuing the surrender, and all you can see beside him are a pair of women's boots, because the woman standing beside him has been airbrushed out of the photo just to, I suppose, make it clear that this is Pearse standing next to Lowe, and that, you know, there might not be any confusion here. So it's a sort
but
of
she's
a standard.
The one who brought the flag of surrender.
Exactly. So yeah. on the 29th of April, she's the one that actually ventures forth, enters into a parley. She's detained by Lowe and she's interrogated. Then she goes back to the volunteer lines and she accompanies Pearse for that final surrender.
Very quickly, Ray says, what's the English translation of Cumann na mBan and are they still in existence? I would have thought it's the Society of Women. But
the initial Cumann na mBan described themselves as Cumann na mBan or the Irish Women's Council, and then Cumann na mBan became their sole trading name as such. In terms of their current existence today, Cumann na mBan have been very active, and we might have to go deep into the Falls Road to find them today or further, but certainly all the way through the Northern Irish Troubles they were an active group.
Conor Mulva and Mary Murphy, many thanks for joining me this evening. The Women's History Association of Ireland is organising a conference, Cumann na mBan 100, at Collins Barracks this Friday and Saturday. We've put details on our website. There's also photos there and documents relating to the item. Thanks to Conor. Our thanks today also to our reader Angus McInally for his Scouser turn a little bit earlier in the programme. Before we go to mention a conference on the famine and its legacy, which will be held at Queen's University in Belfast on the 11th and 12th of April. More details on our website where you can podcast this programme. Due to coverage of the Heineken Cup quarterfinal, next week's programme has been cancelled, but do join us on Sunday week on our book club. We'll be discussing White Cargo, the forgotten history of Britain's white slaves in America. Until then, from me, Miles Duncan, and producer Yeti Redmond, goodbye and thanks for listening.